Good morning, and welcome to Black Book Talk. Happy New Year to everybody. This is the January edition. My name is Patricia Welch. I am the Library Lady.
And I'm Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
And O.B. Hill, Mirror Image Books.
And our guest today is Dr. Amadou Fofana, who is the Chair and Associate Professor of French at Willamette University. He is the author of The Films of Ousmane Sembène, Discourse, Politics, and Culture, and he has chosen a fascinating subject. Some of you are probably aware of him, especially if you've attended the Cascade Festival of Films, but if you're not, sit back, relax, and be prepared to learn about really an incredible artistic person. So good morning, Dr. Fofana, and welcome to Black Book Talk.
Thank you. Good morning, Patricia. How are you all?
We are fine.
Starting the year off well.
Well, let me just say this. Yesterday was a very important day. It was the 1st of January. And on that particular day, 90 years ago, the honored filmmaker and author that we're going to be talking about was born.
That's right.
I'd like to say, in terms of the book that you have written, a very, very academic, exercise in intellectualizing on international trade, and I really appreciate the work you put into that.
Thank you.
Well, tell us, give us a brief introduction, and then we'll tease out more information, but give us an introduction to who Ousmane Sembène was and why you were interested in sharing his story with the world.
Ousmane Sembène was one of the most prolific filmmakers, and before making films, he was a well-known author. One of the most fascinating things about him is that he was born in a French-speaking country, Senegal, in 1923, went to school but did not go far in his schooling. So he is essentially a self-taught individual who exercised several trades. He was a bricklayer, a mechanic, a soldier, and a trade unionist, and a globetrotter, really. He traveled a lot. In the 1960s, he was already an established author. He decided that he wanted to do films to reach his old African audiences, because up until then, he was essentially writing in French. And as you certainly know, many people in Senegal were not educated in French and could not read French. So the best way he thought to reach the audience was to give them images, you know, that did not require education in French. So that's how he started. And then he received a scholarship to go to Moscow, where from 1960 to 1962, he studied films. And in 1962, he came back to Senegal, made his first film, Bronze. So that's how he started. Well, my fascination with Sembène started many, many, many years ago when I was in graduate school. I remember watching one of his films, Gelwar, and I was fascinated and intrigued by the way he put that film together and the issues he dealt with, because that was a very provocative film that dealt with foreign aid in those days. It was 1992. That's when the film came out. That intrigue never ended, and I decided I was going to pursue studying his films and to know more about himself first, to better understand his films and to use that as a window to broadly understanding African film.
So, because Mr. Sembène was a film, he was a director who made these films, he was a lone person, he wasn't with the company. How was he able to produce the films?
most African filmmakers, I think I would say most sub-Saharan African filmmakers and Senegalese filmmakers in particular are independent filmmakers. Usually they rely on support from the state, for support from the French government and other NGOs to make their films. They don't typically use professional actors. They use, family relations, personal relations, connections, and that's how they make their films. That's how Sembe made most of his films. It's only starting with Fatkine that he turned toward Morocco, where he found a place to produce his films. But usually he was able to secure money through grant applications and so on.
I noticed that Ossie Davis directed one of them, and he had some named stars, and I think it was Moulade,
that's right.
Moulade.
Yeah.
So, yes. So there, was he getting any kind of backing from the U.S.?
He did have U.S. connections. Whether he was getting financial backing or not, I am not certain. I cannot say for sure. But Sembe was very independent, and he went where he could find the money to make his film. And he didn't hide about that. He openly said, you know, I have my goals. If I need to do something to make my films, I will do it, to find the resources to make my films. So he had no limitations in that sense.
And since this was in the 60s, were the films shown in the U.S.?
You mean which films?
Black Girl and Borom Saret?
Yes. The U.S. is one of the primary markets, as he called it. The West was his source of funding, but also his market. His target audience was Africa, obviously. So, yes, his films are more widely viewed, actually, in the U.S. than they are in Senegal, for example. In most American universities, you'll find films by Sembe Ousmane. You'll find literature by Sembe Ousmane. That was not as usual in those days, because distribution facilities in Senegal, in particular, were not owned by filmmakers. They were owned by French companies who didn't find these films very economically profitable for them to show them.
He was interested in the relationships between politics, religion, and basically he had a trilogy, according to your book, in terms of the types of religion that were recognized. And I was interested in your chapter 5 on that. Could you elaborate a little bit on his reluctance to, although he was born into a Muslim home, how he carried on the traditions of the elders and ancestors?
Yes, Sembe was born in the southern region of Senegal, which is the Casamance. It's a very green, very beautiful region with with a traditional religion. Traditional religion in the sense that it's not as organized as Islam or Christianity. It was essentially ancestral worship. So he did learn how to do that because his parents, especially on his mother's side, were associated with it. So he knew how he was exposed to it. But Sembe was rebellious, and he was born like that, and that shows in his movies and in his life later on. So he was not very obedient. So he also was educated in Quran, which is a necessary step for people born in Muslim families. In order for them to be able to worship, they have to know the Quran to be able to recite it. But at the same time, in the Casamance, you have a strong Christian presence. So he grew in the interface of these three religions. And throughout his life, he essentially preached directly or indirectly was the idea of tolerance, the necessity for people to be tolerant of one another despite religious differences. And he made a specific film, Gelwar, about that. In Gelwar, you see, it beats together Islam and Christianity in a way that is very, very provocative, and that does not necessarily reflect the reality of Senegal, but that it's foretelling of the possibilities of tension between Muslims and Christians in Senegal. Now, Senegal is 90 to 95% Muslim, while statistics are not always reliable in these smaller countries. But there is an overwhelming majority of Muslims and a minority of
exactly. Muslims. When did the Muslims move down into that area and begin to introduce and proselytize the Senegalese people?
Islam came to Senegal, to West Africa, particularly around the 9th and 10th centuries. So Islam has been there since then. And Senegalese West African people took over the proselytizing process. People like El Hadj Omar and so on, who contributed a lot in spreading Islam in West Africa. Christianity came later on.
When did Catholicism come to Senegal?
Around the 17th century.
Okay, long time after that.
Long time later, yeah. I think that explains the fact that in Senegal in particular, a lot of people don't see Islam as a foreign religion because it has been there for such a long time. It has enmeshed with the culture, with the local practices. It's difficult today to tell in Senegalese culture what is Islamic influence and what is traditional influence.
So when the French colonized that area, how did they deal with these divisions in the religion? Did they introduce or push Catholicism?
No, they didn't. They did not necessarily push for Catholicism. The French worked actually with the local representatives of Islam. They worked with them, and they were able to, in many cases, use them to their advantage and to collaborate with them, in order to strengthen their presence. So collaboration was key.
I want to kind of round back to something that you said earlier, because you said it at least twice, maybe in two different ways, but
okay.
you would say, especially Senegalese filmmakers, or, you know, Senegalese filmmakers, da-da-da. So I'm saying, what is unique about the Senegalese film tradition? I'm feeling that there's something that's distinctive from the other surrounding or nearby African countries.
That's right. There is nothing particularly unique. I just want to be a little more cautious, not to talk about African filmmakers in general, not to talk about West African filmmakers in general, because even Senegalese filmmakers have their specificities. It's not like an organized company, an organized society. So each of them finds their own way. That's why I want to narrow it down. To avoid overgeneralization.
Okay, could you talk about some of the other themes that Simbane addressed? I know that he was very respectful of women, and that's one thing that stood out. You can talk about that or anything else that distinguishes him from other Senegalese or other filmmakers.
Simbane was the most vocal. Simbane called himself a griot. Mm-hmm. A griot in the traditional sense is this simpleton, this marginal person who is not afraid of telling the truth, of saying what everybody would be worried about saying, what everybody would avoid saying to save face or to avoid controversy. Uh-huh. Simbane would go head on and say it. That's what he did with all the issues. That all his films are very provocative, are very challenging, and some of them got censored because of that in Senegal. So he wasn't afraid of dealing with tough issues, and he would take clear stance about them. That's what he did with women's issues. Throughout his films, you see a very strong representation of women. He has a positive view of what women should be and how they should be treated in society. You will remember that Senegalese society is very gender-based. Men are brought up in a certain way, women are brought up in a certain way in different spheres altogether. Even though that is changing, White Semben was also a man of his time. The issues that he dealt with were reflective of the reality of Senegal.
Can you give some other examples of films that might have been censored and hopefully not internationally, that we might be able to see the uncut, uncensored versions, but what other things might have caused censorship?
Religion. One of his very, very controversial films is Chedo. Mm-hmm. Chedo came out, I think, in 1971, if I'm not mistaken. Chedo is essentially about the coming of Islam and Christianity in Senegal and the relationship between the traditional powers, right? How Islam overtook the political power in Senegal. And I don't think the authorities in place in those days liked the idea, liked the film. But it wasn't clear that was the reason why. But the issue is that the then president, Leopold Sédar Senghor, took issue with the spelling of the title of the film, which is Chedo. Cheddo. Right?
Why did he take issue with the spelling?
Semben spelled it Cheddo, and the president said it has to be spelled Cheddo.
He removed an E.
A D.
Okay.
He removed a D, right? That was the issue. And Semben and Senghor have this classic relationship of foes and friends, right? They are almost the same generation, but Semben has always been a rebel, and he was a Marxist in his views. He was a trade unionist. He wasn't a highly educated person. And on the other hand, you had Senghor, who was a highly educated and intellectual, a politician and all that. Right, and then more importantly, he was a fan of French language, which Semben was not. Senghor was impressed by the beauty, right, by the rhythm, by the linguistic capability of the French language.
Uh-huh.
And Semben saw the language as nothing else but an instrument of communication that he could use.
Now, let me say this. You also have a very impressive display of utilization of the French language, and I'd like to compliment you on this. The book is a very, very interesting read, especially for non-French-speaking people.
Thank you.
You're listening to Black Book Talk on KBOO.
Did Semben have a family, a wife, children?
Yes, he did. He has. He had a wife. He got married at some point. Divorced. He has wife and children.
Did any of his children go into the business?
I am not sure. The only one child of his that I know of who took part in the shooting of Fatkine, his next to last film, did not really. He was associated with the film, but I don't think he went on to make a career out of filmmaking. He has a child in France who's not at all into filmmaking, and I don't think any other of his children were involved with filmmaking.
Every year, Portland Community College hosts the Cascade Festival of African Films, and I want to know, are any of Semben's film going to be included this year?
Yes, this year we are having a whole retrospective on Semben, a retrospective. We've selected two movies of his. The very first one, Borom Saret, the one that came out in 1963, and Fatkine in 2000. So we'll have a matinee, and I will be leading the discussion of that.
Okay,
I think it's on February 8th.
All right, and I know that, you know, as things, time approaches, this information will be on the website. I happened to check this morning, and I didn't see it. So I said, well, we better get this out.
Yeah, it should be on the program.
And could you tell us again the two films that will be included, and maybe just a little bit about them so people can get ready?
Yes, The Bottom Side is his very, very first film. It's a very simple and straightforward film in appearance, but it's very complex. And in that film, you have all the seeds of Sembène's later theme, well, of Sembène's later themes. So it describes the day-to-day activities of a car driver. Right? It's from sunrise to sunset, basically. He wakes up in the morning, goes to work with his cart. He has a horse-drawn cart. And he carries people and luggage around. So that's what he does. This is 1963, 3 years after Senegal's independence. He does that. At the end of the day, right, he goes into an area where he was not supposed to go after collecting all that money. So his cart got impounded. He goes back home with his cart, and he lost his money and everything. He went back home poorer than he started the day. His wife, who was waiting for him to cook, right, was expecting that he would bring back money home, ended up giving him their child, left the house, taking upon herself to go find food. So in that very first film, you see the seeds of what later on becomes very prominent in his thematics, that is women issues.
And the second film?
Second film is one of the of three that he initially wanted to do. Unfortunately, he didn't get to do the third one, a trilogy of films dedicated to African women. Fatkine came out in 2000. It's about a very successful a business owner, gas station manager, a woman who's about 40 in Dakar, Senegal. So she is able to assert herself in a business in which historically was essentially reserved for men. Yes. So it's a breaking ground in some ways, because it's one of the most light. People call it a soap opera, which I don't think it is. I wouldn't go as far as saying that, but it's a very light movie compared to Sembène's style. It's a huge departure from his traditional movies.
Okay. So you probably said this, and I just didn't catch it. Other than at universities, where might we find these films to be able to borrow them?
Public libraries may have them. You may also find them on Netflix today. Some of them are available on Netflix.
So over a
California newsreel distributes Fatkine at least.
And also, I think the if you go to the IMDb Internet Movie Database, I know at least one or two of them are available for purchase. I think that's as far as we can go on that note, but go to IMBT on the internet and you can see.
Yes. Mnet South Africa would be the other resource. I think they bought most of the rights to his film.
So over a 40-year period, he produced 11 commercialized films?
Yes. I know it sounds like it's not many, but African standard, it is a lot. Because there are very, very few African filmmakers who actually are able to make a career out of filmmaking. It's not easy. A few years ago, I was fortunate to have a conversation with Haile Gerima, the DC-based filmmaker, Ethiopian filmmaker, and he told me that it took him 9 years to raise money to make the film that he was showing us. Tessa that year. So that's how difficult it is for these filmmakers to find the resources they need to make a movie. So every movie is like a major achievement for them.
And add to that that this man was a pioneer. I mean, he started making films, you know, in a continent at a time when this was not common.
No.
So for him to have persevered and done that, and for his films, which were geared to appeal to an international audience, but also very much made so that the average person in Senegal would appreciate them enjoy them and probably see many things in them that others would not. For him to make that decision that he wasn't just going to be commercial and appeal to another audience, that he was making films for his people, I think that's incredible. And also that prior to that, he had had a great career as a writer, recognized as one of the greatest writers of the continent. So that was a life for very well lived, I would say.
I agree. I think it was a big step in the right direction, because post-colonial writing is essentially a reactive kind of writing, and post-colonial filmmaking is also, in a way, a reactive kind of filmmaking. That is, throughout history, people who were colonized were denied a voice, they were denied their own images. So when came independence, people decided that, we will speak for ourselves, we will show images of ourselves the way and project to the world the way we want them to see us, and not always be seen through the lenses of a third party.
And in doing so, inspired movements around the world.
That's right.
Well, we're drawing to the end of this interview. Colleagues, you have any other final questions?
Yes, I think in terms of resources, also the Cascade Festival of Film, of Cascade Festival of African Films, has a library in which you can find a lot of African films, and I think including some of them. That would be another possibility.
Now, we're going to have the pleasure of seeing you at this year's presentation.
Yes, I will be there.
All right, great.
I will be there.
Well, we thank you.
I wanted to thank you, all three of you, for your questions, but also to thank you for the opportunity. I also want to extend my warm thanks to the Cascade Festival of African Films, with which I have been involved since 2005. This is an incredible group of people who are absolutely dedicated and doing an incredible amount of work to bring Africa to Oregon every year. This is a unique festival in the country, in the sense that not only does it bring many, many African filmmakers every year, it also provides an opportunity to see Africa in its diversity, its variety. I think they absolutely deserve all the kudos.
Dr. Fofana, we agree with you about the Cascade Festival, and we also thank you. And now we're drawing to the end of the January edition of Black Book Talk. And we thank our guest, Dr. Amadou T. Fofana. And again, we refer you to the book, The Films of Usman Simbane, Discourse, Politics, and Culture. And we are closing out with music from Regard Sur La Passe by Bembeya Jazz National. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next month.
All right. It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, January 2nd, 2014. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Nastasia Voisin.
Earlier today, another large explosion made contact with the Lebanese capital, Beirut. A car bomb in South Beirut, a Hezbollah enclave, killed 5 people and maybe more. 66 people were injured. This makes the second fatal car bombing within a week. The bomb went off in rush hour traffic. Neither side of the sectarian split took credit for the bombing, which may or may not have had a specific target.
Oregon Representative Jeff Reardon intends to present legislation in February that would ban home gardeners from using certain pesticides. Reardon hopes to add 4 pesticides to the restricted use list, chemicals that have been linked to massive bee die-offs witnessed in Portland and Wilsonville last summer. The pesticide Safari alone killed 50,000 bees. If added to the restricted use list, home gardeners would be forced to hire professional pesticide applicators or use less effective alternatives. Reardon claims his legislation is necessary to protect bees, especially since bee populations have also declined in recent years from colony collapse disorder.
Customer information from 2 popular computer platforms bled data over the weekend. Information, possibly names and telephone numbers of account holders, Snapchat, could be used to create a spreadsheet to exploit later on. Snapchat phone app lets people share photos with each other, but those photos have a finite lifespan on your device. Just as their ghostly company logo suggests, an image will flash across the display for seconds and defrag into the ether. It's unclear what hackers will do with the names and phone numbers. One cybercrime analyst says that the names and phone numbers can be cross-checked to identify people from other datasets collected by thieves. Also, phishing text messages could be sent to Snapchat users to get passwords. On the official blog of video chat program and Microsoft product Skype, read the message, "Hacked by the Syrian Electronic Army. Stop spying." In a somewhat related story, a backdoor for data leaks has been confirmed in some models of the Linksys and Netscape Internet router hardware devices.
Portland's new sick leave law, which became effective yesterday, has business owners struggling to comply with the budget impacts they predict. The new law requires all but the smallest businesses to give employees up to a week of earned time off. Some business owners have estimated that extending paid time off to employees will cost them thousands of dollars. While the majority of businesses support the sentiment of the new law, many are still struggling to figure out new ways of tracking employee hours and benefits. The Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, the agency charged with enforcing the law, has said it will hold off on taking action against violations of the law until May.
High courts in California accepted the first undocumented citizen to the state bar. Sergio Garcia met all the requirements to practice law in the state, and today the California Supreme Court ruled in his favor, allowing him to practice. Two similar cases are pending in Florida and New York. Garcia had the backing of the California State Bar and the California General Assembly. U.S. Justice Department people filed briefs saying that Garcia should be denied privileges. Legislation signed into California law by Governor Jerry Brown would allow undocumented workers who grew up in the U.S. to get professional licenses and graduate from higher education programs, but that is being challenged in court right now. A possible strike is still on the table as Portland Public School teachers and the district enter into two-day negotiation sessions starting today. Teachers say that they could walk off as soon as Monday, and the district says that backup staff may be used if the teachers don't come back. The district says that their contract proposal offers